Welcome, everyone, to this Hoover webinar on preparing for the next pandemic, or really also helping us get through the current pandemic. I just wanted to say a few words up front about the great work that our student research assistants have done in producing this report that I hope will be of help to all of you across our country here in the United States, but also across the world, in understanding better what are the lessons we can glean from this experience so far, and how do we implement policies and take actions to get through this pandemic and then prepare for a future biomedical emergency. I thought I'd just say a few words about how this project came about. I had the opportunity to work with a great organization called the U.S. Civilian Corps to try to figure out how to match people who desired to contribute to the effort associated with the pandemic and the need for people with certain specialties and expertise. And as we're in the midst of this effort, and you'll hear from Noah Scheinbaum, who will talk about U.S. Civilian Corps here in a minute, we also engaged in an effort to try to disseminate best practices and good ideas about how to cope with the pandemic. And in so doing, we realized, well, we can't let these lessons go to waste. We have to capture these experiences and these lessons learned and make them available to people. And then, of course, I have the great privilege of being here at the Hoover Institution at the center of Stanford's campus. And so we recruited some young students, graduate students, undergraduate students to the cause, who volunteered and who did a wonderful job at applying, I think, a very fruitful methodology to this problem of what can we learn from our experience in the pandemic? How do we apply it to get through this pandemic and prepare for future emergencies? And that method was to interview key people who were at the center of the pandemic response, to hear from them about their experiences, what they saw as the most important lessons, and how to apply those lessons in the form of policy and actions that we can all take. If there's a headliner to this, it's that we have to do a better job at coordinating and integrating efforts across our government, between levels of government, and maybe even especially between the public and private sectors. And that's really, really right at the heart of what the U.S. Civilian Corps does. And certainly this effort is really very consistent with the history, the tradition, and the mission of the Hoover Institution over the last 100 years. So our students did a wonderful job. I think what you'll find is that what they've done is that they have wrung all of the partisan politics out of this, and they have made realistic recommendations based on some facts that we have to acknowledge about the nature of our situation here in the United States. And I'll just summarize these quickly. First of all, yeah, we have a federal system of government, so our recommendations have to be consistent with that system of government. We have a free market economic system, and because we have a combination of public and private sector efforts, we really have to coordinate those efforts effectively so if we can have a holistic and effective response. We acknowledge the polarization in our society, and we recognize that these recommendations have to be grounded in facts and reliable statistics and not in conjecture and inference. We also recognize that there was a lot of disinformation and misunderstanding and bad models about the pandemic up front. And so we have to make sure that we allow for the uncertainty that remains, right? This is still an ongoing experience and an experience from which we are learning every day. And then, of course, this is an international problem. So while we're going to fashion recommendations mainly for the United States, we have to make sure that the international dimension of the problem is considered as well. So I'm extremely proud of what the team has done. What you'll hear from Noah Scheinbaum, and then I'll turn it over to our team of students who will brief at the very high level their findings and recommendations. I ask that all of you maybe access the report now and take a look at it, maybe as we're going through this webinar. And then we'll turn it over to the great Chelsea Berkey, who directed this effort, who will moderate the question and answer. So think about what questions you have for our students who have produced this great report. And Kenan, Noah, I'd like to turn it over to you for your comments from U.S. Civilian Corps, the co-sponsor of this report.
Thank you, HR. Thanks for those remarks and for convening this group and everyone for tuning in this morning. I don't want to speak for very long. I want to turn it over to the folks who can speak to the bulk of this report, but just a few kind of introductory remarks. If I can take everybody back to early March for a second, I know it was 7 months ago, it feels more like 7 years at this point. And we remember when this crisis, when COVID-19 was first spreading across the country. One of the calls that went out early on was, as General McMaster mentioned, the call for people to come help. It was Governor Cuomo in New York, and then it was in California. We heard it all over the country. If you're a medical professional, please come help. My co-founder, Sam Simwangu, and I started the U.S. Civilian Corps with a pretty simple premise, which is that we need to make it possible for more Americans to serve our country. Service is not always easy, nor should it be. However, in this time, we saw an acute need. It was never more true than during COVID-19, when the skills were latent in our population, whether they were military veterans or former doctors or former nurses. People wanted to assist and didn't necessarily know how to get involved. So since early March, the U.S. Civilian Corps, our nonprofit, has partnered with executive search firm Odgers Berenson, their intrepid CEO, Steve Potter, and their COO, Kenan Kincaid, who's since become a board member of USCC, to identify and mobilize and surge medical professionals to where they were needed across the country. And as we engaged with the variety of states and facilities and organizations working on the front lines of this response, it became clear just how much was to be done. Now, to be clear, at the same time, there were a lot of bright spots, and I think the team has done a phenomenal job spotlighting some of the successes, the ways in which American innovation and ingenuity were on display, and how in the absence of perfect information or clear guidance, organizations and people have stood up really to fill in those gaps in a really meaningful and impressive way. But we all saw, and I think felt, something that felt profoundly un-American about being told to just stay home and sit on your couch. And we saw firsthand how people wanted to get involved. So thanks to General McMaster and a variety of folks probably on this call today, folks like Rich Sokolow, Rich Byrne, Eng Pottinger, Vice Admiral Bono, Brian Lane, and countless others, we created the Coalition of the Willing that started meeting regularly. And General McMaster made this offer. He said, we are learning so much, we cannot afford to let these lessons go to waste. And so the results of that effort are what you're all going to see today. And it's our hope that that's going to feed forward and make it just a little bit easier to respond, you know, as this continues or the next time. I just want to stress one thing. We are here to serve as an independent voice on this matter. And the folks you'll hear from today, many of whom have become subject matter experts, but I'd rather you think of us as kind of grateful fellow travelers who have witnessed both the tragedy and the heroism during this tumultuous year. And this team has done a remarkable effort over the just a few short months, interviewing dozens of practitioners and policymakers, leaders on the front lines of responding to COVID-19, and synthesizing what they've heard into a series of insights that I hope you'll find clear and illuminating, as well as recommendations that we hope you'll find meaningful and actionable. And theirs is just the latest in a long line of series of services that have come out of the American population during this time. So I'm deeply grateful for their efforts. I'm deeply grateful to to General McMaster and the Hoover Institution for their partnership in this. And I think you all will benefit from what you'll hear today. Thank you.
Great. Hey, Noah, thank you so much. And thanks to you and Sam and Ken and the whole U.S. Civilian Corps team. You've been great partners in all this. Hey, what you're going to hear now from the stars of this, at least seven of the 11 stars who put together this report. We're going to begin with Ziyi Wang. She will cover data and early models, and then we'll just go really staccato right through with the high level observations and recommendations on data, early models, protecting the vulnerable, adaptability and lessons learned from the employment of the military, contract tracing assessment and recommendations, protecting the workforce, how to integrate private sector and public sector more effectively, the issue of testing, and then issues associated with supply chain and so forth. So you have the report, you can follow through during the presentations. And I'll turn over to the first of our seven briefers, Ziyi Wang. Ziyi?
Thank you, sir. Good morning. My name is Zee Wan. I am a second year master's student in international policy.
Hi, and I'm Carter Cleland. I am a senior studying international relations and pursuing honors in international security.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kelsey Kaywood, and I'm a second year master's student in international policy.
Hello, I'm Hannah Delaney, and I'm a fifth year master's student at Georgetown University in the Security Studies program.
Good morning, I'm Ryan Brooks, and I'm a master's student studying international policy, concentrating in cyber policy and security.
Good morning, my name is Kate Yeager, and I'm a senior studying history and pursuing honors in international security.
Good morning, everyone. My name is William Helzer. I'm a junior studying political science and history. At this point, I'll now turn it over to Zee to tick off the presentations.
The first part of the report focuses on successfully mobilizing the medical response, which is key to combating the spread of a novel bio threat. Early responses to COVID-19 were conducted under vast uncertainties. As our understanding of the virus and awareness of remaining known unknowns has increased, we concluded that a successful approach to a bio threat shares early and accurate surveillance of disease spread, reliable and widespread testing, containment and contagion reducing actions, and treatment of the sick and protection of the vulnerable. More generally, the key to a timely and effective response is the ability to adapt, the availability of resources and personnel, the integration of government and private sector responses, and the sustainability of these efforts through multiple and unpredictable waves, as well as the rapidity and accuracy of data sharing with governmental organizations. Which brings us to the first point on early data coding, reporting, and modeling. Inconsistencies in the United States patchwork of data collection and reporting prevented the rapid mobilization to adopt a strategy for widespread testing. Each state had different testing capabilities with different testing start dates and different criteria on who could get tested. States also implemented inconsistent data and reporting procedures. The errors that arose from such inconsistencies included mixed reporting of results from various test types into one single metric, counting all tests from the same individual as separate cases, and different levels of contextual information that skewed the percentage positivity rate. Such errors not only reduced the reliability and usefulness of the data collected, but also complicated cross-state comparisons necessary to monitor the spread of the virus and to surge critical supplies and medical personnel to areas of need. In addition to the inconsistencies of data sharing, all states experienced challenges of data collection and non-representative data with misuse of data metrics, incomplete data recording due to demographics and underlying medical conditions, and delays in testing results. In particular, for non-representative data, the commonly used metric at the beginning stages of the pandemic was the CFR, case fatality rate, which only accounted for diagnosed cases. Instead, we should aim to report the infection fatality rate, the IFR, which takes into account of all cases, including those who did not seek testing, such as asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic cases, for a more comprehensive and representative fatality rate metric. On data collection and sharing, we recommended that public health agencies should modernize their data reporting systems, establish dedicated staff for data processing, increase testing capacity to shift from using the CFR to the IFR, which would prevent excess public fear, and to provide a clearly defined protocol to identify and address errors in data. When changing data receiving entities during the pandemic, the federal government should provide sufficient forewarning, and the HHS should offer clarity in explaining statistical differences. In addition, in preparation for future pandemics, institutions should clarify their responsibilities early on to avoid mid-pandemic reorganization. Now, I'll pass it on to Carter to discuss the application of data models.
Thank you, Zee. So on to models. Models are often used for developing policy decisions, so their consistency and accuracy are crucial. It's easy to write them off as inaccurate or incorrect because they simplify the public health environment by using a limited number of input parameters. Example parameters could include population size, basic reproduction number, or symptomatic period length. Adding more parameters makes the model more realistic, but also more difficult to understand and less generalizable to specific case scenarios. When viewing the model, it's important the audience understands it's not a question of whether the models are flawed, but rather in which ways are they flawed. If their shortcomings can be appreciated, they can be used as valuable tools to inform policy decisions. Based off this information, our main recommendation is to emphasize assumptions and uncertainties upfront when reporting models. The best practice at emergency response would be for the media and government to clearly list the assumptions of the models they're promoting to better inform the public of the reasoning behind and limitations of the proposed policies. Over to you, Kelsey.
Thank you, Carter. The next section of the report addresses measures to protect the vulnerable during public health crises. The CDC defines at-risk populations as those with a higher likelihood of requiring hospitalization, intensive care, or a ventilator to breathe, and who are at higher risk of dying. According to the CDC, two populations demonstrate increased risk for severe illness: older adults and people with underlying medical conditions. Other populations are also experiencing higher risks of infection, including ethnic and racial minorities, people experiencing homelessness, incarcerated individuals, people with disabilities, and rural communities. The causes are multifold and overlapping, amplifying pre-existing socioeconomic and healthcare inequalities. Though nursing homes represent less than 1% of the US population, they have made up over one quarter of COVID-19 deaths nationwide. Nursing homes and healthcare facilities share many of the same challenges, but several are unique to nursing homes. To name a few, first, compared to hospitals, nursing homes are not equipped with the same level of medical professionals, equipment, and resources, resulting in a very different environment for in-house treatment. Second, due to the structure of some nursing homes, it proved difficult for facilities to properly isolate residents with COVID-19. Third, nursing homes had to address the second order ramifications of COVID-19 resulting from social isolation, such as physical and cognitive decline, as well as mental health deterioration. Beginning in August, the federal government distributed $5 billion in funding to nursing homes through the CARES Act Provider Relief Fund for nursing homes. State measures to combat COVID-19 cases in nursing homes include, but are not limited to, forming task forces, approving decontamination systems, and developing testing strategies. Local governments and organizations also devised innovative, locally tailored strategies. Now, Hannah will introduce a series of recommendations.
Thank you so much, Kelsey. So in this report, we provide 7 recommendations on how to mitigate the effects of COVID-19 in nursing homes and in elderly care facilities. So these aim to improve nursing homes' preparedness in responding to pandemics, to reform the structure and organization of nursing homes within the U.S., and to strengthen nursing homes' external coordination with the government and with other entities. So to do so, nursing homes should first improve their emergency response plans with a greater focus on infectious diseases and operational continuity measures. Homes should also prepare for COVID-19 resurgences and future pandemics by maintaining a stockpile of PPE based on their facility's needs. Additionally, part-time infection preventionists, or IPs, should be mandatory in every nursing home with more concrete rules on their duties, hours, and training requirements. This may also be accomplished through training existing nursing home staff on infection prevention measures. When considering baseline nursing home reform, emergency staff protocols and volunteer staff planning should be implemented prior to outbreaks, alongside improvements in nursing home staff salary structures to help mitigate socioeconomic related causes of infection spreading. So in terms of coordination, federal and state government communication with nursing homes should also be improved to keep facilities informed on the developing nature of pandemics and how to best address them. Local community support should also really be emphasized in order to raise awareness about how nursing homes' high vulnerability and to encourage local engagement and volunteering. So I will now address recommendations aimed at protecting other at-risk populations, specifically ethnic and racial minorities and those in rural communities. These challenges are largely related to pre-existing factors such as access to healthcare, but can also still be addressed. For starters, data collection and reporting methods on COVID-19's effects on minority populations should be improved alongside further developments in language assistance services for both in-person and online resources to assist with the dispersal of pandemic-related information. So in terms of testing for COVID-19 and other pandemics, the establishment of testing sites should be prioritized in high-risk communities. Testing and healthcare accessibility should also be expanded for at-risk populations through increased funding towards telehealth services and other similar outreach programs. Additionally, hospitals and care facilities in low-income communities should receive financial support that's relative to their higher risks of infection. And then finally, there needs to be a greater national understanding of existing inequalities and flaws in the U.S. healthcare system that would lead to improved care for at-risk populations during COVID and in the future. So I'll now pass it over to Ryan to discuss the adaptability of the military's COVID-19 response.
Thank you, Hannah. The Department of Defense response by active duty, reserve, and National Guard personnel helped prevent the medical systems in hard-hit areas from exceeding capacity and provided support to weary frontline healthcare providers. The response consisted of three primary components: reinforcing struggling healthcare systems by deploying 61,000 personnel, transporting PPE, ventilators, and other medical equipment globally and within the United States, and assisting state governments with a wide range of tasks from staffing testing sites to processing unemployment claims. Overall, the military adapted very quickly to the challenge at hand, and we have drawn from the lessons learned to create recommendations to further improve their response in case of a future pandemic. First, in a future pandemic, policymakers should recognize the deep pool of talent and capabilities within the military and incorporate them into response plans from the outset. Second, the DoD should develop a registry to check availability of medical personnel in the reserves to ensure they weren't already engaged in fighting a future pandemic through their civilian occupation. The registry data should be housed at the brigade command level and should be centralized so that it is readily shareable beyond medical commands. Personnel should be organized by city, state, and military unit to facilitate visibility into their availability by location. Third, military hospital ships and field hospitals should plan to treat or at least be agnostic in treating patients afflicted with the disease in circulation rather than focusing on treating non-infected patients. Initial plans to treat primarily non-COVID-19 patients were complicated by a lack of demand and bottlenecks and had to be adapted early on. As these patterns have shown up in other pandemics, personnel should be deployed with the expect to treat infectious patients from the outset. Fourth, the DoD should institutionalize and sustain funding for medical task forces, as the ability to rapidly reinforce faltering medical systems is a capability with great potential and one that could also be applied to other types of mass casualty events. Fifth, states should engage in information sharing with the national government on the number of active cases, staffing levels, and ICU capacity to allow the military to best understand which facilities are most in need of additional personnel and respond accordingly. Now I'll pass it over to Carter, who will discuss contact tracing.
So I'm sure you guys all have heard contact tracing plenty, but that's because it's a common element of any responsible pandemic response. The process can help prevent further transmission of a virus by identifying and informing potentially infectious individuals in advance, so that way they can take preemptive measures to self-quarantine and slow the virus's spread. Contact tracing, though, in the US is quite difficult, especially in our federalized system where each state conducts its own method of contact tracing. Exponential growth of caseloads also don't help. During the summer months, it was impossible for contact tracing to effectively match the scale of the outbreak. I mean, think back to July, where we had consecutive weeks of over 50,000 cases per day in the United States. Scaling up contact tracing to meet these numbers requires an exorbitant amount of funding and personnel. Estimates of personnel needed for an effective response range from 100,000 to 271,000 contact tracers, yet the U.S. has only around 40 to 50,000 trained and hired contact tracers. Hiring is difficult because the U.S.'s public health infrastructure relies on volunteers and has unpredictable, heterogeneous sources of funding. It's difficult to recruit contact tracers when there aren't consistently available monetary incentives. The third problem with contact tracing in the current pandemic concerns testing delays and the asymptomatic spread of the virus. There's delays between the onset of symptoms and testing, between testing and receiving a positive result, and between receiving a positive result and tracing all the contacts. It's ideal if we can minimize the combination of these delays to be less than 3 days. Even if the delays are minimized and the individual somehow has a perfect memory, ability to remember all their contacts, Contact tracers are often met with the dilemma of infected individuals not sharing their contacts or providing partial information. Do a mix of Americans viewing contact tracing as a violation of their civil rights, or being unwilling to answer a call from an unknown caller, or perhaps feeling embarrassed for potentially having violated public health recommendations? Contact tracers regularly struggle to obtain complete lists of contacts. Not to mention, there's no guarantee that someone who is contacted for possible infection is going to listen to the contact tracer's guidance. Early contact tracing apps seem promising in solving this whole dilemma. They could collect data anonymously, assist with identifying unknown contacts, and do it quickly. Here's the problem. The apps ran into a roadblock when only a small subset of the population downloaded them. And that's not a problem unique to the US, that's a worldwide problem. Before downloading an app, the app developer has to address all the user's data privacy concerns, like how is this data going to be used? How is it going to be kept? For how long will it be kept? Who is the data going to be shared with? And how much data is going to be collected? At this point in time, apps can't be relied on as the sole guarantor of tracing contacts in an epidemic, but can serve as a supplementary tool to standard contact tracing. Ryan and Z are now going to talk about our recommendations for contact tracing.
Thank you, Carter. Our primary recommendation is to pursue a strategy of decentralized contact tracing. Under this strategy, businesses and schools would operate their own contact tracing efforts during pandemics when caseloads are high, instead of primarily relying on public health agencies. Businesses and schools would work with local or state officials to train contact tracers according to established guidelines, and would then be responsible for tracing contacts among their own employees or students. This has advantages over the current model in terms of scalability, speed and adaptability, and trust. In terms of scalability, decentralized contact tracing allows the government to distribute responsibility for tracing to a wider group of stakeholders and would massively expand the number of contact tracers available. Over half of US businesses are already planning to enact contact tracing plans, and creating public-private partnerships in this realm would improve outcomes. In terms of speed and adaptability, engaging businesses and schools in contact tracing will allow institutions to adapt their contact tracing methods to the environment where they operate in. This will lead to faster tracing of contacts, which is crucial to slowing the rate of infection. In terms of trust, decentralized contact tracing to the businesses and schools that citizens work in or attend makes it more likely that sick individuals will divulge information about their contacts, especially if they know that information will not leave their institution. Trust in businesses and schools is a valuable resource, which is not being fully utilized currently. However, decentralized contact tracing will encounter some difficulties and incur some trade-offs in terms of costs, coverage, and blind spots. In terms of cost, many smaller businesses and schools will struggle to pay for the cost to run contact tracing programs, which may hurt their efficacy and may stop some businesses from reopening. In terms of coverage, this model not only provide coverage for 150 million employed Americans plus 77 million students, but would not cover another 100 million Americans who are too young to be in school, unemployed, or are retired. In terms of blind spots, this model would not cover business customers, exposures in public areas such as public transportation, or in private residences. Despite the downsides, this decentralized model is a method to rapidly scale up contact tracing in a resource and compliance constrained environment without letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. Now I'll turn it over to Zee for the rest of our recommendations.
In addition to our decentralized model of contact tracing, we recommended that contact tracers must be paid and not be volunteers. Tracers need to be work in the language that a local minority group speak, and enough resources need to be allocated to support anyone who's expected to self-quarantine in terms of food, necessities, and insurance. In addition, and that is just to gain support from the contacts through support instead of through surveillance. In addition, quick testing turnaround is necessary for contact tracing to be effective. While tracing speed, and tracing coverage are all affecting the effectiveness of contact tracing, quick testing turnaround is the most consequential element to efficient contact tracing. Additionally, states should consider sending text messages or emails to possible contacts prior to calling them. This ensures that the contacts know to expect a phone call and will be more likely to answer. The preliminary emails and texts can either indicate a forthcoming interview or send out an electronic survey for the contacts to complete. Now, I'll pass it on to Kate, who will discuss workforce mobilization and resilience.
Thank you so much, Zee. So the next aspect of the report we'll be discussing is the workforce element of the report. We've identified three areas that require reform in order to best support a medical workforce responding to a public health emergency, such as a pandemic, and reforms in order to best mobilize said workforce to respond to a need in a given area or setting. Firstly, in terms of emergency licensing for medical personnel, while there have been many legislative measures taken to support the mobilization of personnel, both at the state and federal levels, there is still room for greater legislative support to ease the mobilization of personnel across state lines. Given the fact that medical licensing is granted at the state level, often obtaining a license outside of a professional's home state can be time-consuming and hinder swift mobilization. Currently, approximately 35 states have incorporated legislation that allows for a medical license obtained in a professional's home state to be valid when mobilized to practice in a different state in the event of a public health emergency. The expansion of this type of legislation in the event of another medical crisis would greatly facilitate the mobilization of personnel. This is particularly important in the case that different parts of the country develop different levels of need at different times, as we've seen with COVID-19. Next, in regards to vetting personnel and volunteers, it's clear that vetting processes for mobilizing medical personnel are unfortunately antiquated and insufficient to mobilize necessary personnel quickly and efficiently. In this sense, it's crucial that bureaucratic processes for vetting at every appropriate level are updated and integrated. We recommend that national standards and guidelines be established to advise states on how best to ease the vetting process to facilitate mobilization. Furthermore, partnerships with the private sector have shown to be hugely successful in mobilizing and vetting personnel. We believe they'll be an integral part of the mobilization process going forward. Next, in regards to workforce civilians, resilience, and supporting those on the front line, our findings have shown that insufficient psychosocial support have been provided to frontline workers with high levels of critical incident exposure. In order to support the workforce and prevent further burnout in the medical community, it is crucial that critical incident stress training and support programs are expanded and offered to medical workers at scale. A variety of training programs already exist nationally, including those offered from universities, non-governmental organizations, and even at a federal level to professionals such as those in law enforcement. In this sense, integrating critical incident stress training into both medical facilities and educational institutions such as universities will be crucial support and preparation for the medical workforce in the event of another public health emergency at this scale. Lastly, private sector partnerships will also be crucial to successfully implementing the necessary mental health care at scale for frontline workers. Existing private programs and technologies could be expanded to support the national workforce. This type of remote support, independent from certain facilities, is crucial as healthcare providers are mobilized across cities, states, and even across the country. This marks the end of our presentation on part one of the report, Mobilizing the Medical Response. Next, I'll pass to Z to discuss part two, Barriers to Innovation.
Thank you, Kate. In the beginning stages of the pandemic, the U.S. mobilized all available resources based on a national security innovation base as outlined in the 2017 National Security Strategy to join the battle against COVID-19. The private sector provided important additional capacity and flexibility, but along with that came regulatory and incentive barriers. Private sector engagement in COVID-19 has taken shape in public-private partnerships, shifts in production output, and direct donations from companies. The high level of trust between individuals and their employers gave the private sector more direct influence on people's experience in the pandemic. In particular, public-private partnerships during COVID-19 were robust in the realm of medical countermeasures, including BARDA, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, the CTAP, the Coronavirus Treatment Acceleration Program, and Operation Warp Speed, which is to deliver 300 million doses of vaccine by January of 2021. Congress has already directed over $10 billion to this effort through supplemental funding, including the CARES Act. In addition, private companies have repurposed their resources and expertise in innovative ways to either help combat COVID-19 or to seek to maintain their businesses. 79% of U.S. small businesses have reported that COVID-19 has caused them to incorporate a change to meet their customer, customers' needs. For instance, companies in the alcohol industry have shifted to producing hand sanitizers, and diaper manufacturers and apparel brands have shifted to producing masks. Nonetheless, private sector engagement poses significant legal challenges, as current US privacy laws have ambiguity on the role of private firms in holding data. The United States Primary Health Privacy Law, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, have already been exercised to allow for greater sharing of patient medical records for public health purposes. The long-term impact of using personal data to monitor COVID-19 must be addressed legislatively. On private sector engagement in responding to the COVID-19 pandemic, we recommend leveraging the private sector's relationship-based networks to work across sectors and regions, avoiding forcing customers to choose between privacy and safety, making scientific research exemptions more broadly available to private institutions, and establishing routine public-private partnership teams in the public health sector. Now, I'll pass it on to Carter to discuss testing and therapeutics.
Thank you, Z. So yeah, testing, therapeutics, vaccines. When testing in the pandemic's discussed, we have to understand there's different types of tests that can be used, and there's niches for each one. Table 3 on page 45 of the report gives you an overview of the attributes and limitations for each main test. Highly recommend looking at that. Before going into testing recommendations, I'd like to highlight two points. First is that RT-PCR and antigen tests both detect active SARS-CoV-2 infections, while antibody tests detect previous SARS-CoV-2 infections. The second point is that PCR tests are more sensitive than antigen tests, but take longer to process because of the need to send samples to labs. Onto the recommendations. The first one being utilize pool testing early on in the public health emergency. Pooling is a process where you take multiple samples, combine them, and test it with a PCR test. This strategy can save resources, but is only effective if the positivity rate in the testing region is low, preferably around, actually below 10%. We recommend this strategy early on because that's when the positivity rate is likely to be lower, and there's a need to use resources wisely while the supply chain is built up. Our second recommendation is to conduct a 2-round serial antibody testing algorithm in communities to help determine the infection fatality rate, IFR, and allocate resources. Conducting 2 or more antibody tests provides a much more accurate picture of COVID-19 prevalence by reducing the number of false positives. The testing algorithm would allow medical and public health officials to understand the spread of the virus in a population by identifying the prevalence of symptomatic and asymptomatic cases. Moving on to therapeutics. SARS-CoV-2 is unlikely to be eradicated because of its airborne transmission, ability to mutate, and the uncertainty over permanent immunity. Realistically, we should expect mitigation, not eradication. A vaccine will help, but likely won't be a silver bullet because it only protects against one or a few selected strains of the virus instead of all mutations. Therapeutics have a potential to reduce disease severity, decrease fatality, inhibit secondary infections, and ameliorate symptoms. There's more on this in the report. Fortunately, as we learn more about the virus's behavior and transmission, more specific therapeutics may be developed, though these drugs won't reduce the number of COVID cases unless a prophylactic is produced. So we have 3 recommendations for testing therapeutics and vaccines in future pandemics. First, examine past scientific literature and focus on existing therapeutics before designing new ones. Second, recognize and publicize the potential benefits of therapeutics to return to a new normal. If drugs are able to abate symptoms or reduce the infectious period, then quicker recoveries could be expected and self-quarantine time shortened. Third, engage in community outreach for vaccine uptake. I suggest reading about these recommendations in the report later for more in-depth explanation. But now, our final presenter, William, will briefly discuss PPE production and competition.
Procuring and mobilizing critical medical equipment has proved to be one of the most pressing issues presented by the pandemic. Over the next few minutes, I'd first like to discuss some of the initial challenges in PPE procurement at the federal, state, and local hospital levels before transitioning to examining PPE production, and then close with a discussion of some key policy proposals to better inform not only our immediate actions towards COVID-19, but also prepare us for the next pandemic. The pandemic rocked hospital, state, and federal acquisition teams in early March. As hospitals experienced grave PPE shortages that threatened not only the quality of care of their patients, but also the health of their physicians and staff. With insufficient domestic production capacity for much needed equipment and dwindling local stockpiles, acquisition teams were forced to turn abroad, which flooded the market with new buyers. In China, this caused care facilities, government organizations, and the private sector to actively bid against each other for critical medical supplies, which drove up prices. Because different countries and manufacturers label similar products differently and use different materials in their production, mobilizing critical medical supplies was also hindered by an inconsistent understanding of regulatory standards. Even once these contracts were signed, there were restrictions in foreign customs and air freight delays that limited PPE arrival in the U.S. for weeks. At its core, this failure in response stemmed from a fundamental incongruency between the federal and state level approaches. Thankfully, recent efforts led by the national government's COVID-19 task force have enabled a concrete understanding of necessary regulatory standards for mass acquisition and transport. The need to acquire PPE from abroad mostly came from insufficient domestic production capacity. It was incredibly challenging to acquire key raw materials, including glass, plastics, and rubber. Domestic PPE production also has a critical economic barrier, as the material science industry in China can produce these materials at a significantly lower cost because of the low cost of labor, which inhibited the U.S. from having the similar infrastructural capacity at the scale of the Chinese at the onset of the pandemic. Since these initial struggles, the federal government has collaborated with leaders at the state level to design dashboards that highlighted places with critical need and accordingly directed material to these hotspots. It is due to these contributions that while some areas of the country continue to have a critical PPE need, the country has sufficient stockpiles to send to these regions and is better prepared for the fall and winter ahead, a true success story from the pandemic. In identifying lessons learned from PPE acquisition, we can come away with three main takeaways. One, information transparency is important. Making sure state, federal, and local leaders are all on the same page as to where equipment is needed and the relevant regulations. It's such information that can enable the hospital in need of small-sized nitrile gloves, but with a surplus of large gloves, to trade with the hospital with a shortage of large gloves, but closets of excess small gloves. It's what allows state governors to direct ventilators to where they're most needed and permits federal employees, whether they're on the Hill, DOD, or HHS, to direct mobilization of material. Greater collaboration with the government and private sector can help ensure that all personnel assisting with procurement are sufficiently well-versed in PPE regulatory standards, as well as verifying trusted buyers and sellers. As actors can all work together to maintain a stockpile of essential materials, such as masks, hand hygiene materials, and hospital gowns that help places like nursing homes take quicker and more preventative action against disease spread, without depending on external foreign suppliers or PPE. Two, we need to change incentives to foster a market for domestic PPE production. The federal government should work to provide purchase guarantees for private domestic manufacturers of PPE for the next crisis. While private firms have the incentive and capability to pivot production to PPE or ramp up production in existing manufacturing facilities, the key challenge to stepping up domestic production was the fear of having no buyer. Indeed, companies would be far more willing to surge and sustain production capacity over the long term if the federal government were to provide guaranteed contracts to purchase PPE for government stockpiles. Sustained production during non-crisis times will ultimately be the key to being able to successfully ramp up production during the next pandemic and is a key issue of national security. While the will to be doing so may be strong in the immediate term, as COVID fades into the background in the coming years, legislative action from Congress will likely be needed to legally mandate HHS to purchase a minimum amount of PPE annually. Efforts to establish such capacity, be modeled after programs designed to maintain a minimum size of the U.S. merchant marine, as well as the annual acquisition of Tomahawk missiles for national security purposes. A revitalized domestic manufacturing capacity also has the important national security implication of allowing the United States and our key allies to not be beholden the Chinese national diplomacy that gives dangerous leverage over the United States and its allies during time of crisis. Finally, third, we need to be flexible in applying these lessons to vaccine production and distribution. It's likely to be confronted by similar challenges as actors from different states and regions compete for what's a finite supply. The federal government should continue to prepare for supply chain bottlenecks at the various components of the drug. Ultimately, the PPE response has demonstrated the ability of Americans to show up ready to contribute to the home team by responding quickly and effectively to a complex challenge. The application of these lessons learned will be incredibly vital to resolving the current COVID-19 crisis and also being prepared for the next pandemic. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Chelsea.
Hi, William. Thank you, and to all our wonderful research team for your summaries. I would also like to acknowledge and thank those researchers who could not join us this morning, Maha Al-Fahim, Haruka Ito, and Sophia Boyer. My name is Chelsea Berkey. I am General McMaster's Chief of Staff and Research Coordinator, and I'm also an editor on the report. Thank you to everyone who submitted questions. Please keep them coming. Although we will be unable to address all of your questions right now, we'll get to as many of them as we can. So I would like to pose our first question from Robert to Carter and Z. Robert says, the CDC recently said all of its reported deaths, that 94% of deaths had an individual infected with COVID-19 and only 6% were shown to die of COVID-19. How does this affect your data on the mortality rate of the pandemic?
Great, thank you for the question. So, and Z, if I miss anything, please speak up. My answer would probably be that when thinking about mortality rate, the denominator matters the most, and that's what we were finding, that you need the IFR, like Z mentioned, not the CFR, because if we can find all of the asymptomatic and symptomatic cases throughout the United States, we can more accurately define what is the mortality rate in the United States. And so it's the denominator that matters here. The CDC statement will affect the numerator, still matters, but overall, as the pandemic has gone on, we've found the mortality rate to drop because we test more widely and have a more accurate denominator. We can also look not just at the CDC statement, but international countries' mortality rates and kind of compare to see a general trend in mortality rate, because same disease, it's bound to be roughly around the same mortality rate, at least in types of countries with the similar healthcare that the United States has.
In addition, I second what Carter has said. In addition to his response, I would like to highlight that the average age of mortality due to COVID-19 is in fact not that much lower than the average life expectancy of the United States. So in this case, we can understand that most patients who do die from COVID-19 in fact die from secondary effects. So yes, the CDC statement skews the numerator upwards due to failure in distinguishing COVID-19 as a direct causation or correlation, but as Carter has mentioned, the denominator is more consequential.
Great, thank you. We had a question from Eric asking, did you all study how schools can reopen safely? What systems would they need to have in place to do so while minimizing risk? Ryan, can you speak to this?
Yes, I can. Thank you for the question. So we did look at the contact tracing portion of how schools can safely reopen. And we proposed that schools create an in-house contact tracing programs through working with public health agencies to track staff and students. This is actually easier to do in schools than in some other institutions because schools have easy access to class schedules. So when a positive test is reported, schools could very quickly inform those who are in contact with the individual and switch to remote learning for 2 weeks for their students and faculty. This would, of course, have to be coupled with safety measures like masks, hand washing, interaction with students in other classes, and social distancing. As part of our report, we interviewed some schools in DC who had taken similar steps, and they were quite successful in doing this. These measures would dramatically reduce the spread of COVID-19 in schools and allow students to get the rewards of in-person learning while minimizing the risk of disease.
Great, thank you, Ryan. We had a couple of questions come in about the urban-rural divide and specifically how nursing homes in different portions of the country could be better served next time around or during a second wave of the pandemic. As you all know, there was a skew, you know, John says some 10 to 15% of the population in the whole country accounted for something like 55 to 60% of all COVID-19 deaths. And of course, nursing homes in different parts of the country experience different levels of funding, some from federal, some from state governments, some from privately funded systems and nonprofits. So Kelsey and Hannah, can you speak to recommendations for nursing homes? Did our recommendations take into account this rural-urban divide? And what recommendations would you give to nursing home and long-term care facilities in different parts of the country?
Sure. So we were fortunate enough to interview a number of elderly care facility representatives from a wide range of localities. And we did find that high funding levels for these centers, which can normally be tied to privately owned homes, did not necessarily lead to a stronger COVID-19 response, given the unprecedented nature of the disease. In terms of specific localities that were successful, we did include a case study in the report, which you should all look at, on San Mateo County, that have designated centers of excellence in recent months due to their high standards of patient care and expertise with infection control, but I'll give it over to Kelsey for more specifics.
Great. I think what's probably important to impress on this point is that it's still an unanswered question, and there is some conflicting evidence. So we, even in our interviews, have seen nursing homes on the same street in the same city with completely different outcomes. Some initial evidence points to the local rates of infection being a major factor, whereas in our personal interviews, they've always cited the pre-existing quality of care at the facility, as well as the willingness of staff members to take it upon themselves to rigorously follow protocol.
Excellent, thank you. Nico had a follow-up on that question on how we might provide recommendations to rural communities with American Indian and Alaska Native populations. Nico, I will point you to our oral history collection at the Hoover Institution that will be ready within the next month. We interviewed some local officials in Alaska who spoke a lot to this issue in the transcripts. All right, we have another question from Anna. I'll pose this to everyone, anyone who wants to answer. Anna says, what are your thoughts on maintaining preparedness in the future, 2, 5, 10 years from now, as institutional knowledge erodes and resources are allocated to other more immediately pressing priorities? This sounds like workforce resilience to me. Kate, would you speak to that?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the question. So I think the really important thing about this report is that these recommendations are long withstanding, and we hope to continue to pursue implementing the recommendations that we have formed in order to maintain preparedness in the next 5, 10, 20 years. As we've seen continually over the last 6 months, this will happen again. We will unfortunately face another public health crisis of this scale. And so our recommendations are directly suited towards the next pandemic as well as coping with the current pandemic. In this sense, we hope that these recommendations will be taken on board and we will remain prepared over the next decade or two.
Thank you, Kate. Go ahead, C.
To that. In fact, in non-crisis moments, it doesn't take much funding to support public-private partnerships. In order to have these long-standing teams, I believe you only need around $1 million to support a 50-company-size organization for 10 years. So I believe that will sufficiently carry us through until when the next crisis hits.
Thank you. We had a question on how the military can best help, especially the Guard and the Reserve. How should they be prepared to help? Ryan and William, could you speak to this?
Yes, thank you. So the best place that we've seen the Guard and the Reserve help is reinforcing hospitals who are about to exceed patient capacity or facing staffing shortages due to healthcare workers getting infected. The expeditionary capabilities of the military allows them to surge quickly to in-need areas and prevent these hospitals from being overwhelmed. The second main area that we looked at is in logistics, specifically moving supplies and repairing medical equipment. There will likely be a great strain on civilian transportation networks in a future pandemic. I'm sure we all remember our Amazon packages taking a bit longer to get there in March and April. And this is an area that the military can aid in.
Excellent. Thank you, Ryan. We had another question on data. The question says, there may be a correlation of data for people with or without pre-existing conditions with asymptomatic conditions, or maybe with symptomatic conditions with or without COVID-19. How did you take care to find correlation and outliers in data collection and evaluation?
Right. So we weren't the ones specifically taking the data and analyzing, reporting an exact correlation coefficient. We more looked at the basically who was taking this data and where did they go wrong. And so a lot of it came down to just almost what this question is talking about, like definitions. How do you define somebody as asymptomatic versus symptomatic? I mean, that one's more obvious, but we had other definition problems. Like early on, different states all reported deaths differently. And so that almost attests to the earlier question that Z and I were answering, where how do you define a death exactly? How do you know? How do you confirm? I don't know if I answered that question straight on, but that is the knowledge that I know.
Great, thank you. I have a question next for General McMaster. Michael says, what about the idea of bringing back civil defense as in the 1950s and prior, exemplified a hierarchical organization based on subsidiarity? It had state and federal abilities to respond, but local ability to both assess and recommend responses. Sir, what would you say to that question?
Yeah, I think this is a great initiative, you know, to be able to form, you know, sort of a civilian response corps. It's what U.S. Civilian Corps is organized around, is to do that for, in a non-governmental way and within the private sector. You know, I think, and if you look at just the tremendous team we've put together here at Stanford, there is a tremendous desire to serve among our young people. The National Commission for Service completed its report last year. I think this would be a way to meet the intent of that report with volunteers who can be organized into teams that would be relevant in a crisis and who already possess the expertise within the private sector jobs that can be mobilized and sent to the point of need. So I think that's a great recommendation. And I'll just ask if Noah might want to make a comment on that as well, because this is really what U.S. Civilian Corps has been organized around.
Great. Thank you, sir. I have a question for Kelsey and Hannah back to nursing homes. Karen says, she cites an MBER working paper saying that results suggest that eliminating staff linkages between nursing homes could reduce COVID-19 infections in nursing homes by 44%. Any comment? What did you find on staff linkages between nursing homes?
Yes, absolutely. So elements such as working two jobs, having to use public transportation and other socioeconomic sources of infection spreading are a massive problem within nursing homes. One partial solution that we did mention was reforming nursing home staff salary structure, as well as consistent testing of staff members. But this is a massive problem that's deeply embedded within the nursing home larger structure that definitely needs to be addressed.
Thank you, Hannah. I believe we have time for one or two more questions, and then I will give it to General McMaster to close. This is a question on contact tracing from Josh. Josh says, our report mentions that contact tracing in the U.S. was far less effective than in some other countries. Josh mentions receiving daily calls that are telemarketing or scams. Is that experience unique to U.S. consumers? Josh is curious whether better contact tracing outcomes, for example, perhaps in South Korea or some of the other countries that we mentioned in the report, have been correlated with tighter regulations of telemarketing.
That's a fantastic question. And Z and Ryan, if I miss anything, please join in. We looked mainly at the United States specifically, but you're absolutely right that people don't want to pick up their phone when they think it's a scam caller. I mean, you see unknown number, you're probably not going to answer it. At least I typically don't. So you're right about that being common for US consumers. As to abroad, I mean, contact tracing in some countries is mandatory. In the United States, it's more optional. And so That's as far as I can speak to it. I can't give specific other country case studies, but Z or Ryan?
Yeah, so one of the recommendations that we gave in the report is that the entities doing contact tracing either send emails or send text messages in advance of calling so that people would be more likely to pick up the phone. And hopefully this would avoid some of the problems that you talked to about scam callers.
In addition, the United States mostly rely on traditional contact tracing, which is the calling and then interview procedure. In other countries, such as South Korea, which you mentioned, other technologies such as mobile phone apps or QR codes that you need to scan in order to enter certain buildings, these are more common procedures, and that will certainly have a higher degree of impact on civil liberties, which is the systematic challenge to contact tracing efforts in the United States.
Excellent, thank you. And I'll give it back to General Master because we are at time. Thank you all.
Hey, I think I can speak to all of the, for all the attendees. What a great job by all the researchers and you, Chelsea. I can't thank you enough. And this is a mission that is very consistent with the Hoover Institution's mission, as I mentioned up front. I just want to let our viewers know that the interviews that were conducted with those who were at the center of responding to this crisis will be archived in the Hoover Archive as oral histories. This report will be curated over time. We'll do some additional interviews, but really what we hope to have done is created a resource for congressional staffers and policymakers and state and local government officials and those in the private sector who are working on this pandemic and are preparing for the next biomedical emergency. So it's been a real privilege to be associated with this just high performing, wonderful team of students here at Stanford and our one from Georgetown. and I can't thank all of you enough. I think you should be immensely proud of what you've produced. And this is a form of service that you've rendered to our country and to humanity. So thank you so much for a wonderful, wonderful job. Thanks to all of you viewers for joining us. And it's just been a real privilege to be part of it. Take care, everybody. Thank you.